It is Monday, July 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Zimbabweans cast votes in a pivotal election. California battles devastating wildfires.
It seems to be basically burning out of control.
And a vigorous fitness program helps patients fight Parkinson's disease. It's all ahead. Zimbabweans are voting Monday in the first national election without Robert Mugabe at the top of the ruling ZANU-PF party. Mugabe was ousted by the military in November and replaced by Emmerson Mnangagwa. The former longtime ruler said he backs the opposition movement for democratic change candidate Nelson Chamisa. Council on Foreign Relations Africa expert John Campbell tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, Mr. Mugabe deeply resents being pushed aside by his own party and the military.
What I don't know, and will be watching very carefully, is the extent to which Mr. Mugabe still has influence over the electorate. Now, I suspect in certain, particularly Shona areas, he has more influence over how people vote than we might like to think, given his perfectly dreadful and really quite bloody career over the past, 30 or 40 years. Zimbabwe is a deeply tribal country, and Mr. Mugabe knows how to appeal to that.
The polls are unreliable, but they give Mr. Mnangagwa, the incumbent, just a slight lead. Does the opposition movement for democratic change have a chance in this election, in your view?
It has a chance, but remember, in Africa in the 21st century, elections are stolen not at the polls, but rather where the results are all bought together. And, of course, Mr. Mnangagwa controls that process. So we will have to see.
Well, Mr. Chamisa did say that the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission is biased.
And I think the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission is indeed biased. It is a creation of the incumbent government. And in Africa, incumbent governments always have a huge advantage over challengers.
The government has allowed in foreign media, international observers from the European Union, U.S., and the Commonwealth. Will this, do you think, make a difference?
Good question. I don't know. My basic view is that outside election observers don't see very much, that the people who do see tend to be the indigenous election observers. And the advantage that outside election observers provide is that it becomes much harder to beat up local election observers. The people that I will be looking at are the local election observers. Do they find the process credible or not? That's what I want to know.
Chamisa insists the momentum is with the opposition and victory is certain. Mnangagwa said the choice is clear. Vote for Mugabe under the guise of Chamisa or vote for a new Zimbabwe with an improving economy and more foreign investment. John Campbell said a September 8th runoff is quite possible. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. President Trump and Italy's new prime minister meet at the White House. The United States condemns violence in Nicaragua. President Trump's lawyer says the odds are against the president testifying in the Russia probe, and the Comoros Islanders are weighing a controversial referendum. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute. The Yellowstone supervolcano is thought to have had three major eruptions between 640,000 and 2.1 million years ago. It's been long thought that the volcano is powered by the heat from the Earth's core, like most other volcanoes. But a new study suggests that the volcanic eruptions at Yellowstone were instead caused by hot materials being pushed upward by a huge oceanic tectonic plate that jammed itself beneath the present-day western United States about 30 million years ago. Study author and Virginia Tech Associate Professor Ying Chao says that she did not find any proof of heat coming up from the Earth's core that could have powered the Yellowstone supervolcano. She did find an odd underground structure at about 322 to 645 kilometers beneath the line of volcanoes between Oregon, Idaho, and Wyoming. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, Iranian currency hits new lows a week before new U.S. sanctions are to take effect. The wildfire burning in Northern California has claimed its sixth victim. At a news conference Sunday, Shasta County Sheriff Tom Bosenko said the victim didn't evacuate despite receiving an evacuation warning. Other victims included two children and two firefighters. Authorities say seven others are still missing in the Carr Fire near Redding, a city of 90,000, about 370 kilometers northeast of San Francisco. I asked VOA's West Coast Bureau Chief Mike O'Sullivan if the fire is worsening.
It sounds as if it is getting worse. It's only 5% contained, and we know that six people have died in the fires, including a 70-year-old woman and her two great-grandchildren, two firefighters as well, and another unidentified body was found on Sunday. So firefighters, when these things strike a rural area like this, and this is about 260 kilometers north of Sacramento, a small community of about 90,000 with a lot of outlying people in the rolling wooded hills outside the city of Redding. And it seems to be basically burning out of control. And what firefighters typically do is protect the more populated areas and try to create fire breaks around the perimeters where the fire is slowing down. But the difficulty now is they say the fire has created its own weather patterns. There's so much heat being generated, and it's the humidity is very low, and the temperatures are very high. So it's a real battle for them.
The case involving the woman and her two great-grandchildren was especially tragic. What's known about what happened there?
Not a lot. We know that the family was speaking to the great-grandmother and the two kids, as I believe the great-grandfather was driving back, and they lost contact, and apparently the area was engulfed in flames. So that's about all we know at this point. It's a tragic thing, but when fires are this bad and they're going through residential communities, those outlying communities up in the mountains, if people are still, if they haven't evacuated, it's very risky.
Yeah, and I suppose that's absolutely key when an evacuation order is in effect. People need to move.
That's right. And, you know, they sometimes call these evacuations mandatory, but people don't always respond or they don't respond quickly enough, and there are many reasons for that. Some older people are just not able to get organized, you know, quickly enough. People are sometimes worried about their animals. A lot of people in rustic areas have dogs and cats or horses, and they don't want to leave the animals. So it's a real problem for authorities to try to clear those areas out. And these fires move so quickly that people don't always recognize the danger. They may see smoke, they may even see flames in the far distance, but they don't realize how quickly the flames can sweep through their area.
Well, now, I also believe state officials, Governor Jerry Brown, as well as the federal government, have declared a disaster area.
That's right. And they have to do this to free up the federal funds and the state funds that are needed to cope with the disaster and then cope later on with the rebuilding. But this is an annual thing for us that, you know, fires, it's very dry here all summer. So July, August, September, we get little or no rain. The temperatures are hot, very low humidity, and we've been through about 5 years of drought. We're out of the drought now. It was about 2012 to 2017, but the fire conditions are still very bad in some of these rustic mountain tree-covered areas, and what we typically see every year, you know, even on, during good years, is a lot of fires in these areas, and in a bad year, as we've had recently, we've had many bad years, the fires, we get large fires that just burn out of control. Sometimes they burn until the rains come in the fall, but we're hoping this one can be contained at some point before that.
VOA's West Coast Bureau Chief Mike O'Sullivan. With just under a week to go before new U.S. economic sanctions are due to take effect against Iran, the Iranian currency, the rial, is hitting new lows. The rial reportedly dropped to 111,000 rials to the dollar Sunday, despite the appointment of a new central bank governor and a new economic team by the government. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Iranian Vice President Ishaq Jahangiri announced that the government was putting in place a new economic program Sunday as the country's newly appointed central bank chief took office. At the same time, both Arab and Iranian media reported that the Iranian rial hit a new low Sunday of 111,000 to the dollar, a bad omen for the newly appointed central bank head Abdelnasser Hamadi. Hamadi was quoted by the Islamic Republic news agency complaining that enemies are trying to destroy the country's assets and create disappointment to the public through the new U.S. economic sanctions. Former Iranian President Abu Hassan Bani Sadr, however, tells VOA that he thinks economic and military forces inside the Islamic Republic are trying to pressure Iranian President Hassan Rouhani not to negotiate with the U.S. He says that elements inside the regime are trying to profit from the situation in order to seize power. He thinks that Iran's powerful Revolutionary Guard, which controls much of the Iranian economy, would like to stop President Rouhani from negotiating with U.S. President Donald Trump. And they are threatening to push the dollar even lower in order to stop an eventual normalization of relations with Washington. Bani Sadr argues that the value of the Iranian currency is mostly hypothetical since there isn't really a lot of trading going on. He thinks that the country's powerful militaro-economic mafia, as he calls it, is trying to gain the upper hand on Rouhani by creating economic turbulence as a warning not to negotiate with Washington. Ali Larijani, Speaker of the Iranian Parliament, told the body Monday that Iran needs to modernize its economy. He spoke of building what he called a resistance economy in order to fight against U.S. sanctions. The country's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, first used the term resistance economy to describe Tehran's attitude toward new U.S. sanctions. Iran analyst Gary Sick of Columbia University tells VOA he thinks Iran has been going through a very, very difficult period for some time, and that Tehran has structural problems not related to the U.S. sanctions.
There are serious problems in their management of natural resources and their dealings with what, in effect, is environmental problems, which have been very badly handled over a matter of decades. And a lot of these things are just coming to a head right now.
Sick mentions that entire regions have dried up due to poor water management and that the building of dams has compounded the problem in some places. He says that Iranians in various regions have been protesting due to the water situation, which is unrelated to the new U.S. economic sanctions. But he says the situation has, of course, been exacerbated by the threat of U.S. sanctions going into effect, and it isn't surprising that Iran's currency is being impacted because people don't really know what is going to happen next. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Rocksteady Boxing is a fitness program designed especially for people with Parkinson's, a neurodegenerative disorder that leads to tremors and balance problems. The Rocksteady Boxing nonprofit was founded in 2006. Since then, more than 500 boxing programs have been introduced in the U.S. and around the world. Faiza Almasri visited one of these RSB gyms recently opened in McLean, Virginia, outside Washington, D.C., and talked to boxers there, people with Parkinson's who fight back against the disease. Faith Lapidus narrates.
First drill is going to be the four cone drill, all right? So we're going to go one big step forward, one big step to the side, one big step backwards, one big step to the side, all right? So we're going to go like this.
75-year-old Neil Eisner was diagnosed with Parkinson's around 6 years ago. He was one of the first group of fighters who joined Rocksteady Boxing Nova last December.
My stepdaughter knew I was interested, and she read an article on it. She saw the news before I did, told me about it.
Eisner says he likes the routine their trainer guides them through twice a week.
I think Alec, who's the teacher, is really accenting those features that are prominent in Parkinson's. For example, some people have problems walking or tripping. He works on exercises that affect the legs. He works on exercises that affect balance.
All right, ready? Four, three, two, one, go!
One of the things, interestingly enough, is you tend to have a lower voice. When you have that lower voice, people can't hear you. You don't realize it. So he accents getting us to bring up our voice clearly and more loudly.
For personal trainer Alec Langstein, working with an older population is familiar. He understands their health issues and the need for them to stay active.
My aunt has a gym in Westchester, New York, and she does a Rocksteady Boxing program there. And she invited me up to her gym to check out the program. She thought it would be, you know, perfect fit for what I do. And I helped out with a few classes, and it was just, you know, I thought it was such an amazing program.
Langstein went to Indianapolis, Indiana, headquarters of the Rocksteady organization, and became an RSB licensed trainer. A few months later, he opened his Rocksteady Boxing Nova gym.
So a typical boxer's program, they focus on balance, hand-eye coordination, reaction time, footwork. There's some cognitive stuff, because in boxing, certain numbers equal certain punches. So when I yell out certain numbers, they have to move and react at the same time, so the brain and the body's working together. And it's the also taking out the aggression that some people may have of having the disease.
To understand how RSB can help Parkinson's patients, physical therapist Danielle Sequeira says it's important to know what triggers the symptoms.
Parkinson's disease is pretty much neurodegenerative. It pretty much mainly affects the dopamine-producing cells in the brain, so therefore you have a lack or loss of dopamine cells, which contributes to the movement difficulties. The research shows that exercise helps with the brain use the dopamine more efficiently. My goal usually is after I work with someone with Parkinson's disease, I kind of refer them out and suggest that they get involved in exercise programs out in the community.
So far, boxing seems to help Victoria Hebert reduce the symptoms of her Parkinson's. She has a tremor in her left hand and says certain situations trigger it.
Being cold, being hot, sitting with a crowd that I'm not real comfortable with, I'll start shaking. I end up having to sit on my hand just to keep it still.
But with this crowd, Hebert doesn't feel the need to hide her disease.
These people have become very close in the 4 or 5 months we've been together. That's a big part of it, sharing experiences with others. I have to say, it's kind of embarrassing, but over 8 years of time, I never met anybody else with Parkinson's. And then I came here, and it's like a whole classroom. Now it's up to 20 or 25 people.
We're going to do a competition, all right?
Sharing challenges and hope makes these fighters feel they're not alone and gives them the support and determination to keep fighting back. For writer Faiza El Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
All right, everyone's got to go twice. If you don't know how it's going to be formed.
Thanks very much, Faith. Well, America's dream of space exploration took its first official step 60 years ago this week when President Dwight Eisenhower signed a law authorizing the formation of NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Although humanity had been staring at the stars and wondering since they were living in caves, it took the Cold War to fire a man into space. The world was stunned when the Soviet Union, on October 4, 1957, launched Sputnik, the first man-made object to orbit the Earth. The U.S. was humiliated at being caught short, not just technologically, but militarily. Eisenhower ordered government scientists to not only match the Soviets in space, but to beat them. Well, that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The recent Ministerial to Advance Religious Freedom, hosted by the United States in Washington, discussed ways to combat religious persecution and ensure greater respect for religious freedom. Among the topics of discussion was Iran. In an interview, U.S. Ambassador for International Religious Freedom Sam Brownback said, "Iran has been one of the worst countries in the world on religious persecution."
If you're anything but a Shia Muslim in that country, you do not have religious freedom. If you're a Sunni, if you're a Baha'i, if you're a Christian, if you're a Jew, if you're a Zoroastrian, any of those, you don't have religious freedom.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo described an example of religious persecution in Iran, this time of a Sufi, during his recent speech at the Reagan Presidential Library in California.
Last month, a simple man, a bus driver, a father of two children, and a member of the Iranian Gobadi Sufi Dervish community was convicted and sentenced to death. His sentence came on questionable grounds, following violent clashes between security forces and the Dervishes. He was reportedly denied access to a lawyer before and during his grossly unfair trial. Sadly, on June 18th, the regime hanged Mr. Salas in prison.
Radio Farda reports that verdicts have now been issued against 258 Iranian dervishes charged with national security crimes for participating in the February protests. The International Federation of Human Rights Societies has described the trial of the dervishes as a mockery of justice and a blatant violation of international principles and standards. Sentences include exile, lashings, and long prison terms. On the opening day of the ministerial, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo wrote that the Trump administration is passionate about promoting and defending international religious freedom, not just in Iran, but everywhere. But the challenge, he added, is too big for any one nation. Others, Secretary Pompeo said, must join us as we fight for the persecuted, speak out for the voiceless, and work together to pave the way for greater religious freedom around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.